Our class this evening is a continuation of our Isaiah studies. And in particular tonight we're considering Isaiah chapter 5, verses 11 to 30. Our theme for this evening is God that is holy is sanctified in righteousness. And our speaker is our brother Brian Luke.
Dear brother Peter, it's very nice to be back with you, my dear brothers and sisters. And I did think that I would pass on to you tonight the loving greetings of the Ballina and the Lismore Ecclesias. We've just had a very profitable and very interesting time with those two ecclesias in the far north of New South Wales in what's called the Northern Rivers area. It's the only part of Australia where you have very broad rivers, but short ones that flow from the Great Dividing Range into the sea. They don't seem to accomplish a great deal, but they are very great rivers, very great width of water is merging out of the sea. It's a very different area to be in compared to South Australia. And on one occasion last weekend before, it just rained without stop for 48 hours. And it's hard to believe that when you're living in Adelaide in the first 5 months of this year, isn't it? But one part of Australia like that, I think that added about 5 or 6 inches to the already 50 inches that they've had this year. So within the first 6 months of the year, they've had more than their annual rainfall, and in fact they've had 2.5 times what is our annual rainfall. So there's different places with he, as it says in the scripture, he causes it to rain in one place and not upon another. The Ballina Ecclesia is an older ecclesia than Lismore. Lismore's made up of young families, very much young families. But it really was a real exhortation to see the tremendous support that they, although the effort was not theirs but Ballina's, that they gave to that effort. And many families came with their children and night after night, event after event, and supported those studies which were on family life. It was a very profitable time, 10 days away. The other thing that I wanted to draw your attention to tonight, just in opening, is the remarkable things that are happening in Europe. There are some really very exciting things happening at the moment. And in particular, if we might diagrammatically represent it like this, here is Russia, so to speak, and here is Western Europe, and there is Germany. And over here is the US, on the other side of the world. The big question is, when East Germany joins West Germany, to whom will it belong? Now, the West German government has been saying we will still be part of NATO. That is to say, our relationship will be like that. So says the West German government, but the people are not saying that at all. And it's extremely interesting now that as the matters become, it's only a year away, they say, and unification of Germany will take place. But now, the Russians have come out and said unequivocally that is not even a serious consideration. Now, at first you think, well, for goodness sake, how can Russia ever say what Germany is going to do anyway? If they want to maintain their position with NATO, how can the Russians, especially in their present weakness, how can they prevent that? But you see, brothers and sisters, there really are some terrific arguments. And knowing what we do, we would expect, wouldn't we, that in fact that will not occur, but rather this will occur, won't it? That's what we would expect, that there will be a union of Europe from, as de Gaulle put it, from the Atlantic to the Urals and beyond. And I feel, my dear brothers and sisters, at the present time we can see exactly that happening. Consider this. You may say, well, Russia's got no cards. If she needs West Germany, if she needs her influence economically, technologically. But on the other hand, if Russia says there's no way we want NATO to join, will Germany do it against Russia's will? Here are some of the factors that are against that. German public opinion. I think I might have told you another time, 54%, when Gorbachev visited West Germany back in August last year, 54% were in favour of a European home. That's the European home concept. It's actually a papal concept. But Mr. Gorbachev has taken the phrase up and he's been using it everywhere. 54%, 17%, less than one third of that, were in favour of still retaining links with NATO. That's German public opinion, never mind the government. Secondly, from a security point of view, if the German people said, we're going to be related to these, West Germany, the Western Europe as well, what does that do to Russia? Isolate, doesn't it? And that's exactly what Gorbachev's saying. If you do that, you isolate us for what purpose? Why not involve us? And in this latest interview, in the Time magazine, a thrilling interview, you ought to read it, he says, our great and earnest desire is to be an integrated part of the world economy. But if you make that move and go in that direction, then you have put everyone else in Europe with NATO except us. Why? See, the world won't do that at the moment, will it? Western Europe, I don't believe, will do that. And besides, if it be a point of security, who is the nearest? Is it security to put Russia out in the cold when Russia's only just over the border? Who will come to their aid more likely, if they make a league with the Russians? Will the US come across the Atlantic Ocean as quickly as Russia, who's nearby? When you put that logic together, you can see that really, Mr. Gorbachev in the end has a lot of cards, hasn't he? Now that's the very thing that's being debated at the present time in the summit that has just taken place in the US between Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Bush. The question was, will Germany be part of NATO? And the indication is that Mr. Bush got nowhere with Mr. Gorbachev on that issue.
What about Russia takes out the army out of East Germany, and England and America that is to the same in West Germany, and Germany being neutral, you see? That's what Russia really wants.
I can imagine German people wanting. Well, it's a very interesting question you raise, because Mr. Gorbachev raised the same thing. He said, and I remind, he said, the American people this, that Mr. Bush seems to think that if it's Russian soldiers, wherever they are, they must be there for evil. But when it comes to American soldiers, why, wherever they are, they must be there for good. He can really talk that. You see his point? And then he made this, then he said this. He said, our boys have already come home and will continue to be coming home. That is to say, from Eastern Europe, which is sort of in there. I left that out. But he says, our boys are already going home and are continuing to go home. What's he saying to America? Your boys go home too, isn't he? But I mean, it's not very far to go home when it's next door, is it? But if you've got to go across the Atlantic, that's a very much more decisive. Isn't that a thrill, my dear brothers and sisters? That really is a thrilling time to be alive. We are living in momentous times indeed. Now, last class we dealt with the opening verses of Isaiah chapter 5, which had to do with the vineyard. We saw how thoroughly the record of Scripture contains that figure of speech for Israel, which is summarised in verse 7. For the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. You remember how that he said he chose, in verse 2, he planted it with the choicest vine. That's the pleasant plant of Judah. For it was, of course, in Jerusalem, in the line of King David, that the choicest of Judah was found, and the choicest of Israel. And he looked for judgment, as it says in verse 2, that he looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. So he looked for judgment, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry. We might call, in verse 7, the words judgment and righteousness the fruits of the Spirit. He came to a tree and he parted its leaves. We're really using the figure of a tree there. We're in a sense gone away from the vineyard. It was the vine in verse 2 that the husbandman came to and looked for grapes in verse 2. But you will remember that the Lord Jesus, I'm sure playing upon this, used the figure of the fig tree. And he came to the fig tree and he parted the leaves to see if there was fruit. And there was none. And when he did that, and he actually enacted it, didn't he? And he came next day and he cursed that fig tree. And of course it was symbolic of Israel. There's a little bit of Isaiah 5 in that, isn't it? Looking for the fruit. And the fruits of the Spirit that he looked for can be summarised in verse 7 as judgment and righteousness. But behold, he found oppression. And for righteousness, behold, a cry. You'll notice in the margin that for oppression, it has the word a scab. It's not easy to just work out how the Hebrew can mean those two things. But one thing is very interesting. There's actually a play going on, a little echo of terms, which might be interesting. And there's a lesson behind the echo. The word for righteousness is the word that we've come across before. Must be absolutely making the teachers free, mustn't it? See writing on the board like that. Never mind, can you read that? T-Z-D-A-Q-A-H. And the word for cry is the word T-Z-A-Q-A-H. Can you see what that's saying? He came to find Zedekah and he found Zaka. And the same thing is done with the next two words as well. Or rather with the two previous words. The word judgment, that's the word for righteousness. And that's the word for cry. And the word for judgment is the word mishpat. Can you read that all right? And the word for oppression is the word there we are. So he looked for mishpat and he found mishpash. See how the prophet's playing upon that. Why has he done that? In the parable of the vineyard, what did he come to find? Come on, Mike, you've got it. Yeah? What did he come to find?
Fruit.
All right. Look at a bunch of grapes. Can you be sure whether that's going to be sweet or sour? There's a lot of difference. When you look at them, they look the same, don't they? So that's what the prophet is saying. When you read those two words, you have to sort of stop yourself and have a second look before you realise that, in fact, they're different. So that's the little play that is being made in the Hebrew upon those things. It looked as though it was good fruit, but in fact it was wild grapes, as he says in verse 4. Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. And understanding goes back to Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 32. For their vine is of the vine of Sodom, and the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall, their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of dragons and the cruel venom of asps. Deuteronomy 32, verse 32 and 33. Now, I just want to complete that picture of the vineyard by reiterating again the words of chapter 27, because that vineyard is not always going to be so disfoliated and barren as that one will be in Isaiah chapter 5. But in the 27th chapter, in the same prophecy, we have this beautiful description that we read the other day, verse 2, "And that day sing ye unto her a vineyard of red wine, a vineyard of red wine. I, Yahweh, do keep it." The husbandman has come back into his vineyard. The beloved has come back as husbandman. "I will wat it every moment, lest any hurt it. The wild boar will no longer go through. I will keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle?" You remember in the 5th chapter, the briars and the thorns took over because of the unrighteousness of the vineyard. Verse 6 says, "I will lay it waste." This is Isaiah now, Isaiah 5. "I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I also will command the clouds that they rain not." The contrast in 27 verse 4 is very clear. Fury is not in me. The anguish is gone. The judgment is gone. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? Rather than use them now to bring punishment upon his vineyard, they now are seen as opposed to the husbandman, the beloved, who has returned. "I would go through them. I would burn them together. Or let him take hold of my strength," verse 5, "that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me." So the world at large is going to make peace that was the thorns and briars. They are going to make peace with Yahweh of Israel. But of Israel, verse 6, "He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud, and fill the face of the world with fruit." I want you to notice the striking contrast of that with Isaiah 5 and verse 24. You've got the root and the blossom, all right? Look at Isaiah 5 and verse 24. "Therefore as the fire devoureth the stubble, and the flame consumeth the chaff, so their root shall be as rottenness, and their blossom shall go up as dust." That's again talking of the vineyard, see? Because they have cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts. Their root and their blossom is gone. But in 27 verse 4, it takes up those figures again and says what a difference it will be. Israel shall take root, blossom and bud, and fill the face of the world with fruit. In Zechariah chapter 8, there is another beautiful prophecy of the time of fullness and blessing. Zechariah 8 and verse 12, "For the seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give her fruit, the ground her increase, and the heavens shall give their dew, and I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all these things." Now, in verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 5, the prophet begins with the description, "Woe unto them." Now you notice that that's not the first, not the only time in this chapter that that occurs, and we'll comment upon that later. There are six woes, in fact, in the rest of this chapter. The rest of the chapter is indeed a very tragic description of God's judgment upon his people. It's one of the most bitter and all-encompassing chapters of judgment in the prophecy of Isaiah. And in verse 8... he begins with a particular dirge against those, as he says, who join house to house, that lay field to field, until there be no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. "In mine ears, saith Yahweh of hosts, of a truth many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant." You notice the reiteration of the word houses in verse 9 and contrasted with verse 8. In verse 8, the wealthy and influential were joining house to house and field to field, as though they would completely obliterate the humble and the poor and needy from that which God had given them. Now, it may have been, if we turn back to the record in Chronicles, it may have been that the very example of the king was somewhat responsible for this. In the second of Chronicles 26 and verse 10, we commented last time that the figure of the vineyard was a very relevant one to the king. For the king loved husbandry, and he had vine dressers in many places. Also, he built towers in the desert and digged many wells, for he had much cattle, both in the low country and in the plains. The plains, by the way, means the south, the area just east of the Philistine area. That was called the plains, or the south. So he had much cattle both in the low country and in the plains. Husbandmen also, and vine dressers in the mountains and in Carmel, which means a fruitful places, for he loved husbandry. Now when he did that, he would have fulfilled what Samuel had said a king would do. Go back to the very historical words of Samuel now. In the first of Samuel chapter 8, he told them in the very beginning that that's what a king would do. In the first of Samuel chapter 8 and verse 14, he will take your fields, he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. Now, we're not told that Uzziah did wrong in what he did. It doesn't say that in Chronicles. We are clearly given to understand that Ahab did do wrong. In fact, in the second of Chronicles 26, it says that Yahweh blessed him greatly as long as he sought Yahweh, and until he was strong, he walked strongly in the ways of God. Nevertheless, if he had such large possessions in so many different places, was there really all of this free ground? I don't believe there was in Israel. As somehow or other, the king had become involved with these things. Now, how often that is a matter of contemporary prophets? In Hosea chapter 5, for example, in verse 10, we read this. The princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound. Therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Now, as you know, Hosea was a contemporary prophet. If you look at Hosea verse 1 and chapter 1 and verse 1, he began in the days of Uzziah. And 5 verse 10 says, the princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound. Therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. That's a very significant quote, because it's showing, you see, that if the king had done that, as seems so in the Chronicles reference, then the princes had followed in suit. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 19, there was a comment about this type of thing. Before they went into the land, Moses saw that that was likely to occur. Deuteronomy 19 and verse 14, there was legislation given against this. Thou shalt not remove thy neighbour's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land that Yahweh thy God giveth thee to possess it. Now, they hadn't even received the inheritance when that commandment is given. But it says, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance. 27th chapter, verse 17. There was a curse put upon he that should dare to alter those landmarks. Cursed be he, verse 17, that removeth his neighbour's landmark, and all the people shall say Amen. So if we come through to the Proverbs, we find a most interesting little reference there to the same thing. Proverbs chapter 23 It's really quoting Deuteronomy 19 and verse 14. Proverbs 23 and verse 10. It says, "Remove not the old landmark, and enter not into the fields of the fatherless." Now where it says the old landmark, literally it means the border of olden times. And you can hear the echo there, can't you, of Deuteronomy 19 verse 14, which they of old times have put there. So that's a very interesting reference in the Proverbs. It's actually quoting the statement given, the law given, in Deuteronomy 19 and verse 14. Well, who was it who gave that in olden times? We know, of course, that it was Joshua. And just to complete that, particularly for our young, in Joshua chapter 14, the record is given of how that land was given by Lot. What an exciting little time it must have been in Israel, as every family came up to Joshua and the high priest Eleazar. In fact, he's mentioned first. In Joshua 14 and verse 1, "These are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed for inheritance to them. By lot was their inheritance, as Yahweh commanded by the hand of Moses." And just put there Proverbs 16 and verse 33, isn't it? Where it says that the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of Yahweh. Now, my dear brothers and sisters, just for a moment, think how excited you and I would be if we went up and there was a grandpa and grandma, and here was our family, and we were going up to Eleazar and to Joshua to find where we were going to live in this beautiful land that God had given us. It might be over there, it might be down there, it might be over this way. And so there in the lap of the high priest, or in the lap of Joshua, the different little markers, whatever they were cast up and down until a hand was taken out, rather one of the stones or whatever it was taken out by hand, and that was number such and such. And Eliezer and Joshua would say, "Well, alright, now that starts over there from that hill, and you go down to that rise, across to that tree, down that valley, and then it goes back to that tree over there," and so on. And you can imagine the excitement, can't you, as that family left and they went to discover that which God had given them. And they were caused to understand that that was not by chance that they received that, but the whole disposing thereof was of Yahweh. So when they went out there, they gathered the stones. Some of these are still found in Israel to this day. They gathered the stones and they made a little a pillar, a post, a landmark, as it's called. And they didn't have anything else, so they just put one stone upon another until that was there. Now, that wasn't really very difficult to remove, was it? It wasn't that in Jerusalem there was a bureau which kept exactly, by surveyed accuracy, the details of your property, and cost you some thousands to obtain it, like it happens today. Every property from the GPO has an exact beginning place where it begins, and exact measurements and angles. That's a new concept. In Israel, it was just by that very simple means. Well, what supposing you had a very wealthy person next door that had all kinds of influence in the city? And if he sent his servant up during the night and he shifted the landmark by 100 yards, and you came out in the morning and said, "Hey, look, that's not right." And there'd be an argument. He'd say, "Yeah, of course it's right. Look, you see the old stones, it's old as ever." Because how would you make your point? And you had no chance of defeating it because he knew all the people in the city. He had the whole thing stacked against you. That's the kind of thing that these proverbs are speaking about. There would come an ability to be able to shift those landmarks by wealthy, powerful people who, uncaring of the poor and needy, would simply shift the borders to suit themselves. Or it may be that their neighbour next door had fallen into hard times and come to them for some degree of relief. And so he had said, "All right, well, we'll take this and this from you." And when the time of Jubilee came, that was supposed to go back. But obviously at this time, that was not actually happening. If we go back to Isaiah in these early chapters, we find that there was already noted an indifference to the poor and needy. In Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 14, "Yahweh will enter into judgment with the ancients of his people and the princes thereof, for ye have eaten up the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your hand." houses. Isn't that powerful? Is in your houses. And in the first chapter of Isaiah, and verse 17, learn to do well, seek judgment, seek, relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, plead for the widow. Verse 23, thy princes are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loveth gifts and followeth after rewards. They judge not the fatherless, neither doth the cause of the widow come unto them. So the widow, the fatherless, the poor, the needy, it came to seek judgment and redress of these matters. But the wealthy had formed a clique of their own. They were not therefore going to help the other person because they were in it themselves. Everyone loves a gift. And so by bribe and by iniquity and by the power of their own persuasion within the places that counted in Israel, they were able to get their way. You know, what would God say of our world today? If this is what he thinks of what it was in Israel, what would he say in the days of the great multinationals? You know, that this world's in for an incredible shake-up, isn't it? The vast multinationals that everybody recognises, governments themselves, are well past being dealt with. Nobody can deal with the multinational companies today that just gobble up whole businesses. A man has sweated for years and his children after him. They just come up and buy him. They either bring the price down, because what does it mean? If they bring the price down in a locality like, say, South Australia for a short time and knock up the local opposition. I mean, all around the world they're commercing in the same things. If for 6 months or 12 months they can lower that price beyond his production figure, then they will. Knock him out of business and there's another one. Isn't that a filthy, rotten, devilish world that we live in? There's absolutely nothing about it that is seemly. But it's around the world. They couldn't care less. It's their promotion that counts. You know, in the prophecy of Micah, there is such a striking comparison with what we have in Isaiah 5. And again, we're in a contemporary prophet, aren't we? The prophet Micah, who prophesied in the days of Jotham, Ahaz and Hezekiah. Look what he says in Micah chapter 2. True, he didn't apparently prophesy in the days of Isaiah, but he may have been, in fact, living in the days of Isaiah. The terms of Micah 2 are remarkably similar. Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it because it is in the power of their hand. That is to say, they can make all the machinery of injustice work towards their ends in the city. And they covet fields and take them by violence, and houses and take them away. That's exactly the terms of Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 8. So they oppress a man and his house, even a man and his heritage that God gave him, is the emotion of the prophet. A man and his heritage. It didn't come, did it? From man to man, it came from God. They came out of Egypt. They'd wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. For 38, they were just simply, literally wandering around. And all of a sudden, they were given this beautiful land that God had prepared for them, flowing with milk and honey. And their hearts went toward that, and in praise to him who gave it. And every family looked at what they had and thanked God. But here were the rich and mighty that said, we are now going to carve this up for ourselves. And the prophet says, therefore, thus saith Yahweh, behold, against this family do I devise an evil. That's a retort to verse 1, see? From which ye shall not remove your necks. Like the needy, couldn't find a way to get redress, see? You won't be able to get your necks out of this either, says God. Neither shall ye go haughtily, for this time is evil. In that day shall one take up a parable against you and lament with a doleful lamentation and say, we be utterly spoiled. He hath changed the portion of my people. See the little word portion? They were all given a portion of the Holy Land, weren't they? And now he says the Holy Land together is a portion that I gave my people. They will lose their portion as a whole, because when they were upon that and had each family a portion of that portion, they despised those to whom I gave it. So they will lose the whole of it. So he uses that same little word again. So verse 4, and lament with a doleful lamentation and say, we be utterly spoiled. He hath changed the portion of my people. How hath he removed it from me? Turning away, he hath divided our fields. No one else could redress it but Yahweh, and he did. Therefore thou shalt have none that shall cast a cord by lot in the congregation of Yahweh. And that's playing upon the original way by which individual families receive their portions. Isn't that beautiful? So Micah, in a very similar passage, it says that God's judgment will come. There was another consideration, of course, about the land. Leviticus 25 is important in this context. Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 23. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. There's the principle. Ye are strangers and sojourners with me. The land is mine. And so this evil land grabbing and mass development of houses and fields was despite the fact that every one of them had received what they had received from Almighty God. So Isaiah 5 and verse 9 says, in mine ears said the Lord of hosts, which is his title of militants, of a truth many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. Verse 8 is the sin, verse 9 is the judgment. And you'll note there the play upon houses. They put house to house. Well, of a truth, many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair. It won't any longer be the houses of the poor and needy, but it will be the houses, the great and fair houses, that will be in fact without inhabitant. Notice also again this depopulation of the land. Chapter 4, verse 1. In that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread, wear our own apparel, only let us be named by thy name. Chapter 3, and verse 6. And in their desperation to find someone to lead the land, they just grab hold of their brother and say, you be our king. So there will be a scarcity of population. They will be without inhabitant. Look in verse 9 there too, where the prophet says, in mine ear. Isn't that interesting? Saith Yahweh of hosts. It's to emphasize the directness of God's statement of what is going to be, what is going to follow. In mine ear. That's the certainty of it. I've heard God say that. It's been spoken right down mine ear, so I couldn't miss it. The 22nd chapter, you've got the same figure of speech in verse 14. And it was revealed in mine ears by Yahweh of hosts that there should not be any mishearing, no question as to whether in fact he said it. And God hates that principle, but that principle, my dear brothers and sisters, is indeed all through the world today, isn't it? That mania that we have in the world today for vast possessions obtained by whatever means, for the aggrandizement of the few. In Australia, in recent year or so, we have seen some amazing things in that regard. Some of the great and powerful men of the land have come crashing, that have been about exercises that surely would have made Isaiah's generation seem like small fry, and yet they have come to a crash in recent times. A foretaste of what is to come. I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 23, because if these things have their greatest fulfillment in the days of the Lord and the vineyard that he spoke about, he gave the parable of the vineyard, he updated it, didn't he? So Matthew chapter 23 and verse 38, we have the expression, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Your house is left unto you desolate. Of a truth, many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. And you know, that would have to be the temple that Herod built, one of the greatest features, one of the greatest houses that the world had ever seen until that time. So in all of these things we'll see that there is an updating to the generation that was in Jesus' day. Now in verse 10, in keeping with the desolation of buildings, verse 10 says, yea, 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and the seed of an homer shall yield an ephah. Now a bath is about 8 gallons. It's an old English measurement of volume, and it is about 8 gallons. We haven't got Brother Richard here to ask him how many gallons one could expect to have from 10 acres of vineyards, but there is a quotation or figure that I have here that 8 gallons would be about 1/500th of the normal expected yield. I would think in today's quantities it would probably be much greater than that because of irrigation and so on. Their prosperity was going to be utterly decimated. They would have a yield of just 1/500th of what they would normally expect. And it says, and the seed of an homer shall yield an ephah. But an ephah is 1/10th of a homer. So they sow their wheat, and when they come to harvest it, they've only got 1/10th. What they sow. So that powerfully illustrates, doesn't it, the decimation of their economy that would come upon them. What a rebuke also that is upon the king's husbandry, who had perhaps set the mark in this respect. Now in verses 11 and 12 we have the second woe. Woe unto them that rise up early in the morning. Some people say that to their children. But here is an evil. It says that they may follow strong drink, that continue until night, till wine inflame them. Now these woes, just for a moment before we get into this, the matter of this, you'll notice that there are 6 of them. Verse 8 is the first, verse 11 is the second, verse 18, verse 20, verse 21, and verse 22. So there are 6 woes, aren't there? Now here's a very interesting continuity of thought. Keep your hand there and come through into Matthew. We've already seen that Matthew 21 contains the Lord's updated version of the parable of the vineyard. Parable of the vineyard is in Matthew 21, verses 33 to 43. All right. Have a look back at chapter 21 of Matthew, verse 19. He hungered, verse 18, and when he saw a fig tree in the way, another symbol of Israel, he came to it and found nothing thereon but leaves only. That's very similar to it, isn't it? And it was cursed, like the vineyard was cursed. Now look at chapter 23 of Matthew and verse 13. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And verse 14, woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. And on go the woes, verse 15, verse 16, verse 23, verse 25, verse 27, verse 29. Isn't that interesting? And then verse 38 says, of chapter 23, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. So there's a real similarity of thought there, isn't there? Now the power of that is that without a shadow of a doubt, our ultimate application of Isaiah 5 must be to that generation, mustn't it? It will have its application to the Assyrian invasion. It will have a very strong application to the Chaldean invasion. But its greatest application is going to be to the Roman invasion in 87. Isn't that interesting? That's a clear-cut way of showing that. There's the Lord picking up our chapters in Isaiah, and he's bringing those through in that very precise manner. All right, the second woe, verses 11 and 12 of Isaiah 5. Woe unto them that rise up early in the morning, that they might have strong drink. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10, it has a comment about this. See, these inebriated rulers of the land had lost the purpose of their rulership. It was a great social evil, apparently, of their times. And so Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 16 says, woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. There was always some kind of custom about the king's royal table at evening. But when people only got up, and probably got up later than that, but if they did get up, they got up to eat and to drink. It was missing the point of existence and a purpose and responsibility, wasn't it? And what's more, Isaiah says, for they probably had some rest in the afternoon to get over their festivities, he says, that continue until night, verse 11, till wine inflame them. They had no responsibilities in life. They got up early for alcohol. They slept it off in the afternoon, and they were ready for the night again. A totally useless life. And it reminds me of reading of the times before the French Revolution. Have I ever told you about that? Very interesting. There was all these great provincial lands. But where were the lords? They were not back on their properties administering them with care and causing them to be very fruitful so there was plenty in the markets. They were with harshness dealing with their peasants who were upon those lands. Where were they? In having a frivolous time in the towns. And if they could possibly afford it, they were there in Versailles in the presence of Louis XIV, XV and XVI. Having a grand old time, doing exactly what this says here. And what happened? The people just revolted because they could no longer stand the oppression of their eldership. Isn't that interesting? Very similar indeed. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these quotes. I just want to give you a list, however, of the references in contemporary prophets to the same thing. Amos chapter 2, verse 8. 4 verse 1 and 6 verse 6. Hosea chapter 4 verse 11 and 7 verse 5. In all of those passages, there is an emphasis given to this kind of activity in which eating and drinking unnecessarily, eating and drinking in extravagance, had become a sin of the people. See verse 12? Here's the environment. And the harp, and the vial, the tabret, and pipe, and wine are in their feasts. It's a bright old royal time of indifference, isn't it? But they regard not the work of Yahweh, neither consider the operation of his hands. Now, I want you just to note the link up between verse 5. Sorry, come through the Proverbs first. Just a couple of Proverbs that provide us some warning of these things. You know, as a people, we do not drink, do we? And we certainly do not drink among ourselves. man may do in his own house may be his own business. But where that may in fact affect other brethren and sisters, we are very wise to refrain. That has always been our practice, and I pray God we are wise enough to see that that will always continue to be our practice. In Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 20 it says, "Be not among wine bibbers, among riotous eaters of flesh." You know, people go out and spend $10, $20 for a bottle of fluid. They're crazy. Absolutely crazy, aren't they? $20, $15 for a bottle of fluid. Whereas a good drink of anything that's healthy and nutritious is quite satisfying itself. Be not among wine bibbers, among riotous eaters of flesh. That's exactly the description that we have in the prophecy. In the 29th verse, in verse of chapter 23, who hath woe? It's interesting, isn't it? Who hath woe? Like Isaiah. Who hath sorrow? See, the woe and the sorrow are coming in the judgments of God. Who hath contentions? Who hath babbling? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? You know, so often economic and physical plots are experienced by people who indulge in this way. Their families become difficult to manage, and all kinds of problems are there. Even where I've come from, my dear brothers and sisters, again, I was impressed by this very issue. And I plead with us all in our personal examples to each other to be very discreet and wise in what we do in these things. They that tarry long at the wine, they that go down, that go to seek mixed wine, look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth his colour in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold evil things, strange women. Thine heart shall utter perverse things. Make a fool of yourself, don't you? In a state of inebriation. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. It had a hold upon them. And in the 31st chapter of Proverbs, there is advice given to kings, specifically given to kings. It is not for kings, verse 4 of Proverbs 31. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law, and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Now that's a very interesting connection between verses 4 and 5. When the mind is dopey under the influence of alcohol, how can that person see the correctness of God's law? And so verse 5 says, lest they drink and forget the law. Now come back to Isaiah and see how pertinent that is to the times in which he lived. Here's this great feasting and carrying on. But look at verse 12. But they regard not the work of Yahweh, neither consider the operation of his hands. Now you might say, well, in what sense is that meant? The work of Yahweh, the operation of his hands. Well, there isn't much doubt, really, but we must follow this through just to get the connections. See verse 19. They say, spurningly, let him make speed and hasten his work, that we may see it, and let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw nigh and come, that we may know it. Do you know what they're spurning? Do you know what they didn't know? They didn't know that the day of visitation was coming. They couldn't see the signs of the times. They were so preoccupied in their feasting and having a good time that they knew not what was coming. That's the work. The work is a work of judgment. And in the 28th chapter of Isaiah, we have a reiteration again of this word. Verse 21, in a judgment upon Israel. You might question me about that later, but I did a little bit of work on Isaiah 28 in this area just a few days ago. that's confirmed that this is not about Armageddon. For Yahweh shall rise up as in Mount Perazim, he shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work. There's the word again, isn't it? And bring to pass his act, his strange act. Verse 29. Yahweh of hosts, which is wonderful in counsel and excellent in working. Chapter 29 and verse 13. For as much as this people draw near me with their lips, with their mouth and with their lips to honour me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men, therefore behold, I proceed to do a marvellous work among this people, even a marvellous work and a wonder. It's judgment, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. And their works, verse 15, they shall come to naught, because they're in the dark. Now, in Habakkuk, you will remember, there's a combination quotation of Isaiah 29, verse 14, and Habakkuk 1, verse 5, through into Acts 13. But pick up Habakkuk as we're going, and if you've still got Isaiah, you'll see how close the language is to Isaiah 29, verse 14. It's a combined quotation. Got that? Habakkuk 1 and verse 5. Behold ye among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvellously, for I will work a work in your days, which ye will not believe, though it be told you. What work? Lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land. So it was a work of judgment. And Israel would not believe it because, well, how could he bring the Chaldeans upon them? They were far better than Chaldeans. And so how could God unjustly bring the Chaldeans upon Israel, though Israel might have sins? Now in Acts 13 and verse 40, this language is updated. Habakkuk relates it to the Chaldeans, but in Acts 13 it's related to the Romans, because we've come past the time of the Babylonians. In Acts 13 and verse 40, beware, says the Apostle Paul to the Jews in Antioch, beware therefore lest that come upon you which is spoken of in the prophets. Behold, ye despisers, and wonder and perish, for I work a work in your days, a work which ye shall in no wise believe, though a man declare it unto you. Now he says that's in the prophets, plural. See that in verse 40? Because it's a combination quote of Habakkuk 1 verse 5 and Isaiah 29 verse 14. So if we come back now to Isaiah 5, we find that what we have here is the first in that series of references to the work. And the work is a work of judgment. Coming back then to Isaiah chapter 5, it says, but they regard not the work of Yahweh, neither consider the operation of his hand. Therefore my people are gone into captivity, because they have no knowledge, and their honourable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Now there's a very powerful reason to be at Bible class, isn't there? And there's the reason. We cannot afford, my dear brothers and sisters, in the latter days, if we ever could have been, we cannot afford to be another place on Wednesday night. Let's all take that to all of the members in our meeting with open heart and plead for greater attendance. We cannot afford for our eternal life to be other places on Wednesday Bible class. We need to be here because we need knowledge. We need that firing up of each other. We need to realise that tomorrow, Thursday, we are different people and we need that stimulus. And if the Ecclesia has organised to have a class, then let us make that our heart's desire. They're not only there, but there with our tails back, so to speak, that we might be able to inspire each other in the race for life. You see, it says, they will go into captivity because they have no knowledge. You know what Hosea 4 and verse 6 says? My people, it says, they are destroyed through lack of knowledge. Jesus said, you know not your time. In Luke chapter 19. There's a very real imprint, the power of those words to our ecclesial life today. You know, we in South Australia are resting on our laurels. I haven't much doubt about that. I really felt that last week, and I thought that I should say that to us all. Because if there's sufficient humility of heart among us, we can look at each other and admit that. Our Bible class attendance and our attendance on a lot of other meetings is not strong at all. And we need to face that and stop resting on our laurels and imagining we're doing all right. That's exactly what Isaiah's generation were doing, weren't they? Saying, we're okay. And it's time South Australia ceased patting themselves on the back and got back to Bible class and learning the Bible. How many of us are genuine lovers of Bible information? There was a time when after class we'd have a whole ring of people talking about that record. I'd love to see that again tonight. Come up and talk about it. Young ones come up and learn about the scriptures together. And gender a love of Bible study. Because if we're not thinking like that, there's a reason for it, isn't there? Other things are creeping in on our lives. And we're not burning with the interest, which is the hallmark of a true Christadelphian and always has been, that loves to increase their knowledge of the Word. Bible class is a class to learn. Not quite the same as Sunday morning has exhortation, indeed. But it is a place where we expound the scriptures. And we ought to have a love to learn about the scriptures. So that when we're sitting with our children in this desperate age, we can make the reading sparkle with interest. And we can cause them to realise where their lives should go. So that it will not be said of our generation, they knew not. So whether in the last week or fortnight or month, we've done a little bit of Bible study. Let's say tomorrow night we will and get back to where we used to be. Do you know when we began our ecclesia we had 32 members and we had a Bible class about 30 members. Now we're 150 almost. And our Bible class might be half as much again. About 45, 50. That says it all, doesn't it? Don't let anybody rest on their laurels. And if we can bring our children, if they get their homework done, then bring them to the Bible class. It's no good. We're baptizing person after person. But our Bible class attendance remains the same. It is not good enough. We should be able to fill this hall with the membership that we have. And look what that would mean to both the atmosphere of the class and the speaker, the chairman and everybody else. Our ecclesia will be getting back to the word of the living God. So that we're enjoying his word and learning and growing together in it. So verse 13 says, their honourable men are famished and their multitude is dried up with thirst, in contrast with all the eating and drinking, you see, of verse 11. Therefore, verse 14, hell hath enlarged herself and opened her mouth without measure. Proverbs 30 and verse 16 says, the grave is never filled, doesn't it? And opened her mouth without measure, and their glory, and their multitude, and their pomp, and he that rejoiceth shall descend into it. And the mean man shall be brought down, the mighty man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. Chapter 2, verse 9. See there that first part of verse 15 is taken from chapter 2 and verse 9, and the second part, the mighty man shall be humbled and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. That's taken from chapter 2 and verse 17. And verse 11, of course, is the same as verse 17. So that's a reiteration and shows again the continuity of thought which is in these earlier sections of the prophecy. But Yahweh of hosts, verse 16, shall be exalted in judgment. And the holy ale, verse 16, as the literal Hebrew is, the holy ale, it shall be sanctified in righteousness. And so by his judgment he would bring them back to himself. My dear brothers and sisters, all of us know Ezekiel 38. And the last verse in Ezekiel 38, it tells us that when God arises, and this is the greater judgment, far greater, the whole of the earth is going to sanctify Yahweh of hosts. You know, we're living on that. We're drawing diagrams about Armageddon here and the unification of Daniel's image. It's time we got back to our Bibles, and that's the message for tonight, isn't it? peel ourselves away from a perishing world and draw together to love the scriptures and cause our children to love them and love them ourselves and talk about them and grow in knowledge. You know, the prophet later on will lament the fact that he could not speak to that people except line upon line, precept upon precept, not because they were learning the scriptures, but because they were like children. You couldn't teach them great and meaty things. They lost concentration. They lost the whole drift and meaning of it. Well, let's be people that love to have a bit of good solid meat in our ecclesial diet so that we can chew upon it together, obtain its sweetness and its strength and its nutritious value to us spiritually, and grow as a people loving the scriptures. Thank you.